I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Korean Peninsula is split in two, as you know. This is a story about a man who has lived two extraordinary lives in both countries on that peninsula, one life in North Korea, the other now in South Korea. Of course, North Korea is a place where you can be thrown into a prison camp for watching certain movies or if you're caught with a Bible. A country that poses a nuclear threat and is also responsible for some of the worst human rights violations in the world. That's what this man, this defector from North Korea, is up against as he tries to alleviate the suffering of other North Koreans. This story comes to us from our WGBH partners at the Ground Truth Project and reporter Kelly Kasulis.
We're outside of Jung Gwang-il's apartment building in southern Seoul, getting ready to head over to an island along the border of North Korea. But it was clear right away that he was having a little trouble waking up.
Mr. Jung's stomach hurts.
Drinking.
From drinking, he says.
Drinking all night.
I've interviewed Mr. Jung before, and this is the first time that he's ever been hungover. But somehow, it's a perfect portrait. On one hand, he's living large, drinking too much whiskey and enjoying being a grandfather. He's 56 years old and remixes Korean ballads in his spare time. On the other hand, Mr. Jung is haunted by his past. He's dedicated his free life, the one that began when he made it to South Korea, to helping people still in the North. And he's found himself on the world stage at a defining moment in the history of the Korean Peninsula. When he's not at his day job at a furniture store, he's running an organization called No Chain for North Korea. It's a ragtag group of North Korean defectors and some supporters. They raise money to send food and forbidden media to North Korea. That's why he's up so early today, despite the hangover. Several members of No Chain for North Korea are here in the parking lot outside of Mr. Jung's apartment. Their cars and trucks are loaded up with rice, medicine, and USB thumb drives to make the 2.5-hour trip to the border.
Maybe I should get in the front.
I'll sit behind.
Yeah. We're getting in Mr. Jung's car, but it's clear that he's still waiting for someone.
So he's from the police, so yeah, he's from the government, I guess.
Mr. Jung is looking for his security guard, a police officer paid for by the government. There have been several cases of North Korean spies or radicals trying to assassinate defectors in the South. I know one defector whose door was broken down with an axe. When I asked Mr. Jung about his safety, he sort of just laughs and says, I mean, what could really happen?
Will they actually try to kill me?
The security guard shows up and gets in the car with us. Mr. Jung gets in the back seat and shows us something on his phone. It's an article from a North Korean state newspaper.
The North Korea newspaper that reported that he tried to sneak in North Korea with a bomb for terror.
The article claims that Mr. Jung tried to bomb a statue of Kim Il-sung, North Korea's first leader. To be clear, this didn't actually happen. Mr. Jung is grinning as we read it.
He seems like he's amused by this. Not that amusing. I mean, they're threatening to kill me. The article is threatening to kill him.
The atmosphere in the car suddenly changes. That's the thing about Mr. Jung. He jokes around a lot, but his work is deadly serious, and it's fueled by a lifetime of trauma. I should pause here to fill you in on Mr. Jung's backstory. When he was a kid in the 1970s, he remembers life being pretty good in North Korea. His family got government food rations, and they watched propaganda movies together in the evening. Like this one about Japan's brutal occupation of the Korean Peninsula. When he was about 17, he joined the military for his mandatory 10-year service. When he got out, his parents arranged his marriage and the government assigned him a pretty desirable job as a trader of goods to China. He had two daughters, and life looked promising. Then Kim Jong-il took over the country in the 1990s as a horrible famine swept through North Korea. Conservative estimates say about 250,000 people starved to death. Mr. Jung was able to keep feeding his family because his job as a trader gave him easier access to the black market. But he remembers the horror of watching children waste away in the streets.
So whenever he goes to work, he could see bodies of people piled up on the street who's died of hunger.
Late one night in 1999, Mr. Jung was sleeping when officers raided his house and arrested him with no explanation. They tortured him in a dark room with other prisoners for 8 months. Mr. Jung went through something called pigeon torture, where soldiers tied them into a crouching position with their hands chained to the wall behind their backs. He drew pictures of this for the United Nations years ago, along with drawings of people being beaten and eating rats and snakes to survive.
He is still haunted by nightmares.
Mr. Jung couldn't even hold himself up by the end of those 8 months. His weight dropped from 165 pounds to about 80. It turned out someone had accused Mr. Jung of being a spy. He eventually made a false confession just to get the torture to stop. Then Mr. Jung was transferred to Yeolduk prison camp, a heavily guarded labor colony with about 46,000 political prisoners, including children. At Yeolduk prison camp, armed guards forced Mr. Jung to do hard labor for 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. The winters were so cold that the dead bodies of other prisoners would freeze into what he calls big jellied blocks of flesh, and Mr. Jung would have to break them apart with a shovel and bury them as part of his job.
He did not get any respect as a human. He was treated like an animal at the concentration camp.
3 years later, in 2003, the government decided that Mr. Jung was actually innocent, and they released him from the prison camp. But he found that his house had been seized and that his family was gone. Mr. Jung's friends had already helped them flee to China. Mr. Jung bought a Chinese cell phone on the black market, one that the government couldn't monitor, and he managed to track down his family. Just 12 days after leaving the prison camp, Mr. Jung snuck across the border into China by swimming across the Tumen River. He reunited with his family, and together they crossed through Southeast Asia with the help of Christian missionaries. The South Korean embassy in Cambodia then helped them reach Seoul. And when I ask him about it, he almost seems to block it out. What do you remember from that time? What did you see?
They are just fully focused on surviving and making it safely to South Korea. So there's nothing he could really remember. It's not like they could sightsee or see other things.
It's been 14 years since Mr. Jung made it to South Korea. 14 years of rebuilding his life, but never forgetting the people he left behind. His friends, neighbors, fellow prisoners, even family. Mr. Jung has a younger brother in North Korea who calls him about once a month using a burner cell phone. So let's get back to the car with Mr. Jung and the focus of the day, sending food and USB thumb drives full of forbidden media to North Korea.
So it's all just dirt paths from here to the shore, and you really can't see anything. It's all white because of the fog. We have arrived.
Finally.
After 2 hours of driving, we've crossed over a bridge to an island just 8 miles across the water from North Korea.
Okay, so we're at the shore.
We're at the shore and they're unpackaging the bags of rice and Bibles and ointment and everything else, just inches away from the water. Some groups like No Chain send goods to North Korea using drones or balloons, or even smugglers on the border of China. Mr. Jung's latest sendover strategy is a little different. He sends the packages in the water. He waits for the lowest possible tide, which happens twice a month, and then lets the current carry the packages to North Korea. The packages are waterproof. The rice and USBs are in recycled 2-liter water bottles. They're stuffing Bibles donated by a church into sealed plastic bags and then taping them to the sides of those bottles. Aid sent to North Korea is often supplied by Christian churches, and missionaries are also known to get involved with North Korean human rights. They even funded an entire technology university in North Korea. Today, in total, Mr. Jung and No Chain are sending 1,500 pounds of rice, 400 USB thumb drives, 400 parasite treatments, 200 Bibles, and $150. Once the tide is at its lowest, they're throwing the bottles of rice and other goods into the water, and you're starting to see them flow down the current towards North Korea. In about 6 hours, the packages will reach North Korea, and they'll probably be picked up by young soldiers, men who are often underfed and forced into their job. Mr. Jung is okay with that outcome. He hopes the USBs will be passed along so that each one can have an impact on multiple people. Some North Koreans, the wealthier ones, do have computers and smartphones, but the government has the power to monitor them very closely. A lot of North Korean devices can automatically detect foreign media files and stop them from opening. In some cases, the devices even delete them. North Korean phones are also known to automatically take screenshots, and police can ask to see them whenever they want. At least one big name has taken an interest in Mr. Jung's work.
We have a very special group of people with us today. These are escapees from North Korea.
On January 2nd, 2018, President Trump invited Mr. Jung and other North Korean defectors to the White House to talk about North Korea's human rights abuses.
I thought through our really fabulous interpreter, we could probably go through a couple of the stories because they're incredible and very inspirational.
Mr. Jung was the second person to share his story.
Yes, go ahead.
Jung광일입니다.
My name is Jung Kwang-il. I was also imprisoned in North Korea, a political prison. So I was there for 3 years.
Mr. Jung goes on to describe his work with No Chain. He also tells Trump that he was moved by a speech he gave at the South Korean National Assembly 3 months earlier. He translated Trump's speech and included it in his sendovers to North Korea.
Thank you very much. Hope it helped.
That's
great.
In June, months after this meeting, President Trump had his big summit with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Mr. Jung was not optimistic.
He doesn't really understand why people think Kim Jong-un is more like a messenger for peace. He rather thinks that he is a devil with a smile on his face. He killed his own brother. He assassinated his brother, and also he killed one of the relatives. So he's the person who doesn't really treat the people in the way they should be.
Trump claims he mentioned human rights during the summit, but there's no public record of what he said. Mr. Jung wants to be hopeful, but he's not convinced that the summit will have any real effect on the still unfolding tragedy of North Korea. He called it political theater.
Last question. Mr. Jung, do you think you'll do this work for the rest of your life, and what are you hoping for in the future?
그래서 이 노체인 일을 이제 평생 하실 것 같나요?
네, 어떤 때는 포기할 생각도 있었어요. 그런데 이
At some point he wanted to give up, but now he feels like he has a sense of responsibility and a sense of duty to make this work. Especially considering that there are still people and friends back in North Korea in the concentration camp. And he was the only one who got released. So he feels some kind of responsibility to make it work for the rest of them.
I can barely hear the last thing Mr. Jung says.
Sometimes he dreams about his friends.
Thank you.
That report from Kelly Kasulis and the Ground Truth Project here at WGBH. For a longer version of that story and for photos of Mr. Jung and his colleagues, go to theworld.org. You're with The World.